Hello and welcome back to Shorts.
This is an occasional series we're doing where we interview publishers, and in this case, authors as well, of new literature.
In this episode, we're talking to John Mitchinson, publisher at Unbound, and Jonathan Meads, whose latest novel, Empty Wigs, is being released this very week, I believe.
Very excited to read it, and hopefully the conversation gets you hyped as well.
Okay, let's get to it.
Welcome to the show, John and Jonathan. It's an honor to have both of you.
Thank you.
To start, I mean, we were just curious about each of your backgrounds as readers. How did you kind of catch the literary disease?
My mother was a school teacher, and she taught me to read before I myself went to school.
Mm.
I had no siblings. I had to kind of make my own amusement, and that was books of one kind and another. I read lots of, won't mean anything to Green Penguins. Green Penguins were thrillers.
The crime series.
Stories, etc. I mean, from the kind of golden age of, so-called golden age of detective story, to things of much higher literary quality, like Jeffrey Household, and English publications of American writers like Chandler and Thin Man. But I mean, I just worked my way through literally hundreds of these books to the point where they started introducing bodily fluids. But I mean, I don't think that at that age I'd have differentiated between what is now called literary fiction and fiction. I mean, I think it's a very false division anyway. I mean, why something which is set around a kind of triangle in North London should be a better book than something about a killer on the loose? It doesn't make any sense to me. It's like the thing which I've often quoted about Duke Ellington, saying the question is not whether it's classical music or jazz music. The question is whether it's good music.
We recently did a book from Manchette, and we did talk in depth sort of about this blurred line. I think for a lot of us readers, like, books are our first friends in many ways. That's why we get so attached to them. John?
I mean, it's sort of a similar story. My mum was a school teacher. She taught me to read.
But not to understand it.
It's one of the only things I can genuinely say I'm quite good at, you know. There are many things I'm not very good at, but reading I am, you know, I do it a lot. So for me, I suppose it was also not the mid 60s when I think was reading, late 60s, early 70s, pretty amazing golden age of children's writers, you know, Alan Garner, Susan Cooper. It was seemed to be a lot of puffins. There seemed to be an explosion of really good writing. Leon Garfield, Joan Aitken. I think a lot of us got kind of the habit, went to the library. I used to save up all my 5p's that I was given as pocket money each week, and that meant I could afford a new paperback every month, which was exciting. I've still got stacks of those books from childhood. And then that kind of, a bit like Jonathan, then it's, I think at a certain moment you kind of start reading. I started reading thrillers, you know, terrible Wilbur Smith and Desmond Bagley. Didn't think they were very good.
But Desmond Bagley did good plots.
Yeah, they were good plots. They were exciting.
But and that's all there is to those things. There's no,
and as you say, bodily fluids are beginning to make a bit of a sort of an entrance. And I also remember reading the Ian Flemings and loving those. I think that the strange thing is it's probably a lot of things go wrong when you get taught literature, you know, and
yeah.
You get taught that there's a canon, and you get taught. As a publisher, I've always tried not to follow that kind of. I don't understand people who can't read different kinds of books. I think if all you wanted to do was just to read literary fiction, you would be a very strange, unbalanced kind of person. I think. I feel, maybe not, but you'd be an odd publisher. I've always felt that the best publishers, you know, the Tony Godwins at Penguin, or you know, the Tom Mashlers at Jonathan Cape, they were always omnivorous readers. And they were, yes, they might have been reading Marquez, but they were also publishing Ian Fleming, you know. And that to me is sort of, the best publishers still have that kind of catholicity of taste, because I think that's what people are like. You know, people don't wake up in the morning saying, I must find another literary novel.
Well, I think that leads well into my next question for you, John. How did you come to co-found Unbound, and what was the idea behind it?
The reason I came to it, I'd been a publisher before. I'd started on a more conventional publishing journey. I was a bookseller, and then I joined an extraordinary publisher called Christopher McElhose, and we bought the Harville Press out of HarperCollins, amazing backlist of books that many of which find themselves, I think, now on the NYRB list. That was a pretty good place to start. And again, you know, Christopher was interesting. He was publishing incredibly literary stuff, as you would now say, a lot of great Russian writers, Solzhenitsyn and Pasternak, Bulgakov.
The literary stuff which Nabokov absolutely despaired at.
Yeah, yeah.
The Russians, who he thought were their only quality was that of humanity and worthiness. There's no technique, no tricks, no enchantment.
No. And then, I mean, so the Unbound story is I left publishing having had enough of it. Worked on a TV show called QI, which we created and wrote books around that. It was a very different kind of world. And then a couple of friends had books turned down. I suppose this is about 2009, 2010. And I'd been hanging around with a lot of people who were kind of described themselves as web 2.0 people in London, looking at, I think there'd been a massive crash. A lot of the early websites had all gone, you know, the bubble had burst, and these people were trying to find different ways of doing things, interesting things on the internet, which was still possible back in those days, very early stage of social media. And a company called Kickstarter had started, and I was immediately struck by them because it suddenly looked to me, a friend of mine said, can you help me find a printer? I've raised $10,000 for a truly terrible novel that he'd published. Anyway, it just struck me as there was an interesting idea. I didn't think it was going to, I didn't think the Kickstarter model, getting authors to do their own printing, didn't seem to me to be. But I loved the idea that there was maybe a revival of the 18th century idea of subscription and advance, that the internet could be.
Mm-hmm.
If you asked readers to support a book, you might end up being able to publish a much more interesting and eclectic and diverse selection of books than what was increasingly felt like the big groups were now, their kind of editorial scope was getting narrower and narrower, and they were kind of turning everything into, well, they say hit factories, although not quite enough hits, I think, for them to be massively profitable, but certainly profitable enough for them not to take risks anymore. So it was definitely, the idea was to try and start something that was where you, as it were, readers and writers were in closer contact, that you were going directly to the, plugging yourself directly into the enthusiasm and interests of readers, and not allowing W.H. Smith or Waterstones or the marketing team of Barnes & Noble to determine what books got published. So that was the very simple idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first six books we put on the website was an amazing collection of essays by Jonathan called Museum Without Walls, which went on to fund and still sells.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you, Jonathan, as a writer with this publisher. How did you get involved with Unbound, and how does the process compare to other publishers with these essays? You know, you put out a cookbook. It's really great. What has it given to your writing process?
Well, there are two things there. How did I get involved? I got involved because I had written something like 60 television essays, which generally kind of classified as documentaries. They're not documentaries. They're one-man shows, but done in front of a camera rather than in front of a theatrical audience. Mm-hmm. And I'd sort of been thinking of putting these together. So some of the scripts, some of the pieces that I had, journalistic pieces that I had written around the various subjects, which were pretty disparate. And I took it to my agent. I delivered it to her on a Sunday, And on the Wednesday, she said, no one's interested in this. And I said, well, who have you shown it to? Which she neglected to reply anyway. She became an ex-agent. And I knew John. I knew that he was setting up this, what then seemed revolutionary. Probably does still seem revolutionary, even though it has its roots to 300 years ago. And went with that. And it worked out well. And the Museum Without Walls got, I think, 14 nominations as a book of the year in the sort of Sunday Times, Spectator, New Statesman roundups, which was gratifying. So we proceeded to do some more stuff. Very, very different natures. I mean, one's a box of photographs. Another was a further book of essays and so on. There's a cookbook. Now there's going to be a 1,000-page novel, which, if I'm asked what it's about, I just have no idea, because I have no idea what it's about.
Magnum opus is what we're calling it. Let's be honest. It's the great novel.
Yeah, it's a very large and complicated book. Although I'm not sure if it's as complicated as Pompey, the previous very big novel I did, which was certainly more linguistically complicated than this one. I mean, this one is told in various voices. Some of those voices are slightly approximate to mine. Some are completely different. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, mimetic trick that I've had to play, but I do have the advantage of having trained as an actor, and that does help, although apparently it doesn't help an awful lot of actors.
Mm-hmm. John, you mentioned that your publisher is sort of able to bring out more eclectic side of books that these capitalists minded publishers might not want to bring out. How does your model bring these books that wouldn't otherwise be published?
Well, I suppose, you know, the thing that we do is it's getting people to pledge their support for the book, or to pre-order the book effectively at a much earlier stage than most other publishers would. So the idea really is if you've raised enough money, then you can go ahead and publish pretty much anything. The other bit of the equation, though, I suppose, is that's fine. But all, you know, going back to that original story I told you, you also need to be able to design, to print, to distribute, to market, to sell, to publicize—all of the things that I think authors need in order for their works to get out into the world, and for the books ultimately to reach the widest possible audience. I don't now tend to call it crowdfunding, because I think in a way that's become such a, you know, it's, when I see another middle-aged man cycling across North America raising money for a charity and asking me to contribute to his GoFundMe fund, I mean, you know, I think it is a kind of a more sophisticated version of subscription in advance, of pre-order, so that you hit a financial target and you go ahead and publish, which I think changes the economics. It also means, you know, we can pay the author much more generously, particularly on that bit of the money that's being raised through the website. There's the opportunity for them to earn more money as well, and to feel that they're more involved in the publishing process. A lot of the anxiety that authors have these days, you know, around social media profiles, and again, we can manage that for them. Jonathan hasn't got. Jonathan is aware of social media, but he's not on social media.
Good for him.
That's, you know, that's never been a problem for him getting the targets for his books. Even for a book like this one, which is, as you can imagine, a 1,000-page novel, is quite an expensive book to print. But we're absolutely thrilled to be doing it. And you know, I think it is maybe the sixth thing that we've done together, and all of them have hit the targets we set for them, and also gone on to sell. I mean, you know, there's a sort of strong backlist. This is the first, we republished Pompey, but this is the first new fiction that we've done for Jonathan. In fact, it's the first new novel you've published, Jonathan, for 20 years, isn't it? Since Valor Family Business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. A very early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
That's so, it's the idea is to, yeah, I suppose boiling the model down is, It's the financial side works because it's people really enjoy the average transaction on our website is £38. It's much higher than just buying a book. on Jonathan's puts this, I think we've got two lunches of 20 people for each lunch, which sold out very, very quickly. Other authors, they'll do artwork. Some of them will do literary walks. Some of them will do online chats. We did a great online conversation between Jonathan and the slang lexicographer, Jonathan Green, last year. There's all kinds of different ways of, I suppose, of allowing people to show their support and enthusiasm for a writer's work other than just buying a discounted hardback on Amazon, you know, which is what most publishers kind of are prepared to settle with. So the idea is that we get to publish the books we want. The authors are involved in, you know, Jonathan is very keen on, you know, typography and the way the books are visually presented. I think our process allows for authors to be more involved. Again, it's not just being dictated to by, you know, the marketing departments of major retailers. So yeah, I mean, when it works well, it should work well for everybody.
Yeah, and as an author, Jonathan, do you feel that the relationship with John at Unbound has changed your creative trajectory in any way? Has it enabled you to do things you wouldn't otherwise have been able to do?
No, I don't think so. But I think what I value is a good friend who usually agrees with me, and when he doesn't, then it's his problem. I sort of enjoy working, knowing who my first reader is obviously myself, but knowing who my first reader will be, and having a kind of sort of sympathy with editors. Sure. I mean, an encyclopedia of myself, which is a kind of memoir, was given by its publisher to some 10-year-old, and my initial reaction was just to cry when I saw what this guy had done to it. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And so I said to Nick Pearson, who runs that company, right, I take the book away, or you just get rid of this person, give him copyright for toilet paper or something. It was depressing. And it's something which I can't foresee happening with Unbound. I mean, you know, one's not ecumenically pleased with everyone one's worked with. I mean, there'll be some people who are difficult and some who are not. I mean, I think one problem I have with Unbound, or indeed with any publisher, is covers. I kind of not sympathetic really to the cover of this book, although other people who've been shown it like it, so I'm not going to kick up a fuss about it. But it's not the kind of thing that I would ever have chosen. And one will see, you know, whether, and how much cover actually lifts or depresses a book is moot. I mean, I don't think one can be about that. Mm-hmm.
I think in most cases, the covers we've worked up quite a good look for your backlist, which I think you...
Yeah, it's the Goya ones and so on, I think, are very good. Yeah. I think that this one is just too...
Too garish, too bright?
Yes, too garish, too bright, too flashy. It's not kind of grubby enough.
Maybe we can still grubby it up a bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. There are plenty of other things in the book.
You had a nice... The copy editor did a great job, and it's a big, big book to copy edit.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff that copy editors and so on would have done, and which will... I think they've done their job well. It doesn't show. It's somewhat thankless. I mean, what's the expression? The midwife who believes that the child is her own.
Mm, yeah,
sure.
Yeah, the contents of the book have not been particularly lessened by various stages it's gone through, although given a lot of the material, it's rather surprising that I've got away with it. But of course, in England now, there's no such thing as the Lord Chamberlain, who used to censor plays, and all the playwrights of the generation before mine have stories of these people who are generally sort of old courtiers or army officers who are deemed to sit in judgment on the works of people like Joe Wharton, who they would be absolutely certain they would hate.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you've gotten away with this time.
I bet you're intrigued to see this cover now.
Yeah, we'll add some dirt to it. We'll grubby it up ourselves personally. But John, what have you maybe not done yet with Unbound? You guys have incorporated all kinds of different experiences into your platform, but are there still horizons for you?
We're about to launch, and I'm hoping that Jonathan will be someone who will contribute to this. Is we're about to launch a sort of online, I guess you call it online, kind of magazine where we do a bit of interesting new content into everybody's inbox every day. Obviously, excerpts from books that we're doing, but original pieces, some long form pieces. I think we've got 350,000 active kind of users on that use Unbound. It seems a shame not to force them all in every case to buy a book, or, you know, there are different ways. There are podcasts, there are newsletters, there are other mm-hmm. things that I think. So that kind of digital stuff that we can do that, again, most publishers seem disinclined to wanting to do. In fact, I had a publisher last week telling me that they think their nonfiction sales are being damaged by podcasts. And I'd said, you know, why don't you think you've not thought of trying to commission podcasts? Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's not for us to do. So, yeah, so that, I think that's, there's a whole exciting, and we've got a good, really good team of people. So it's I think that's a definite place for us to go. We've got a list of authors who are always, Substack has transformed, I think, a lot of authors' relationships with readers. It seems crazy for us not to be doing something in that space. So,
oh, fantastic. Jonathan, just a final question, more specifically about Empty Wigs. What exactly was the grubbiness you decided to get into this time? And is there any more grub that you're excited to get into soon? Where are you going to take us now?
It's just like I kind of sluice my brain occasionally and all the stuff comes out. It's rather like kind of cerebral enema.
I mean, it is dark, this book. My God.
The thing is that it's rather odd in that it's widely assumed in Pompey and also in Further Family Business that this was stuff I'd invented it. It was kind of warped imagination inventing. A lot of it was just came to me from, I mean, for instance, there's this scene in which a person whose particular predilection is for giving himself enemas by sucking with a tube stuck into his arse, and he chokes on this. And various people, including my mother, remarked on this. And I said, well, I didn't actually, this was given to me by a friend of mine, Duncan Fallowell, writer, who used to spend a lot of time down near Hay-on-Wye. He had heard this, that it was a local magistrate whose kink this was to suck himself off, I suppose. He choked to death. And I thought, are you going to use this, Duncan? He said, no, what do you think? I said, no, I'll have it then, okay? And he said, yeah. there's that kind of griminess, but there's also a kind of much more profound ennui and sort of anger at the world, I think, which comes out. I mean, in person, and as you can see, I'm kind of cheery, all singing and dancing.
There's a fair few old Nazis in the book.
There are
very old Nazis.
There's the Wandering Jew. There's very curious late 19th century house which is taken over and used as kind of research for zoogenic
humans and animals to interbreed.
Yes, and that there's a lot of that, and even that is not entirely out of my imagination. It kind of quite a bit of it comes from Borovchik, the great Polish surrealist, and there's a lot of cinema in it. The Judecks, there's a constant reference to the battle at Reichenfels, and there was no battle at Reichenfels, but at the beginning, in the epigraph of Alain Robrier's in the Labyrinth, he refers to the fact that there never was a Battle of Reichenfels. So that I've created the Battle of Reichenfels, and it comes in and out. And it is a very elusive book. I mean, there's a lot of the Bible in it. I mean, I don't have any faith whatsoever, but I do enjoy the Bible very much. I do get the impression that God really isn't a very nice guy.
There's a marvelous apocalyptic ending as well, which I think is for people who remember the amazing final scenes of Pompey. It's at least as good, at least as shocking and as beautiful. It's an incredibly rich novel, and you know, plenty of it.
Yeah, I pledged to it the day that project went up, and I've supported many Meads projects in the past, so I don't expect to be disappointed.
That's very nice of you. Always be gracious when given any kind of plaudit. My late friend Snow Wilson, I was with him once, and someone said, "Oh, what you did was very good." And I said, "Oh, this is very nice." And Snow hit me on the back and said, "Be appreciative. It might not happen to you again."
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to share about your working relationship or about Unbound?
The thing about Jonathan is I've loved his work. Both, you know, I discovered his work, I suppose, through the television, but also his first collection of stories, it completely blew me away. I thought it was somebody writing about, talking of a grubby, the kind of England that I just felt nobody else was really looking at or capturing, particularly kind of amazing kind of rural working class, which, you know, I think because he grew up in Salisbury and he'd written so brilliantly about in Encyclopedia of Myself about his childhood growing up in sort of 50s post-war Salisbury. You know, I think always as a publisher, you want to publish the very best writers that you can. And Jonathan, I think, is one of the very best writers writing in English.
Again, that's very, very, very nice. But so much of that book came from my mother, having taught only, you know, sort of just outside Southampton, which is one of the major ports in Britain. But 10 miles away, there are people living in absolute squalor, indigent squalor, and sort of there's one guy who makes a living of collecting scraps from hospitals and sort of selling them on. I mean, it's a terrible life. I mean, like the kind of life in the States, I suppose, that is depicted in, I don't know, Barry Hanna or that sort of deep South where you feel everything is kind of greasy and squalid, and it's not kind of honourable like you get in Faulkner. I mean, there's something kind of really messy and nasty about it.
Yeah, really grubby.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you for bringing Dishonor back to the printed page.
Dishonor.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you so much for listening. We will leave links in the show notes where you can find Jonathan's work and explore more of what Unbound has to offer.
Especially the newsletter that John mentioned in the episode.
And if you are unfamiliar with Meads, I highly recommend the one-man shows, as he called them. I have introduced them to you.
Yeah, I've seen many at this point through you, and they're very fun.
Do you have a favorite?
There's the food one I like.
Which one? There's a bunch of food
That's
ones.
That's true. There's one about the Netherlands.
The Fens?
Yeah, and or it's sort of like Netherlands and England have blurred together.
Yes, yes. That's a fun one. That's a very effervescent kind of
It is very effervescent. There's also a late period one where it's got
late
like...
Late period?
It's I think it's about...
Jargon?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Jargon's good. My favorite is Father to the Man.
Yeah, it's a good one too.
But I always recommend people start with the Scottish trilogy called Off Kilter.
A good starting point.
So there you go. You have about 10 different things to choose from. For our regular listeners, we will be back to our usual type of episode next month, we think.
Yeah.
But goodbye for now.
Enjoy.